Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Welcome back to Radio Islam International. You're listening to the Early Morning Sunday Show. And we come to the last slot for this morning, our conscious consumer with Mufti Muhammad Hafiji from the Economics and Finance Desk of the Jamaica Ulama South Africa. Mufti, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, Afghanistan, and all the listeners of Radio Islam International.
Well, welcome for this morning, and I'm sure that you're going to give us some very good advice with regards to economics and finance, inshallah, this morning. So we can start off. You have some humor for us this morning, I see.
Yes, you know, so a patron walks into a cafe and asks for the Wi-Fi password, and the owner responds and says that it's for customers only. So the patron angrily responds, and what am I? And then the owner responds and laughs and says that the password is for customers only. So the password itself, naming of the password, is becoming an art of its own these days. That's something to really look at. But I think humor is ideal in an ideal sense from an Islamic setting is not something that is pursued on a frivolous basis. We pursue it with the intention of taking a lesson from it. And I think what matters for me in terms of these unsecured Wi-Fi connections that are made available at cafes and eat-outs and so forth, mm-hmm. is that many a time they do present some kind of risks for consumers, and this is what we need to be conscious of. More so when we use these unsecured connections for transactions, you know, on banking or any other kind of accessing of your work profiles or something of that sort. It's important to keep in mind that it's not only the technique you use in naming your Wi-Fi, but also the kind of risk they present for ordinary consumers. So I recently came across a rogue Wi-Fi network, which was titled as free Wi-Fi. You know, the name was given free Wi-Fi.
Yes.
And rogues know exactly how to ensnare innocent consumers. So this is how the name is given, and then this is how you find malware attacks or even snooping, sniffing of your personal data through unsecure Wi-Fi networks. So it's something to be careful of for consumers, not just ordinary humor.
Yeah, alhamdulillah. I think, you know, people need to be aware of this because we find especially our children today sitting in public usually tend to use the Wi-Fi that's available so easily to us, and you know, with the, especially seeing that it's free. They don't realize the risks attached to that. But yes, that's very, very true what you say. Okay, so we're talking today about a bare-bones approach to an Islamic world. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes. Regarding an Islamic world, it should be a given that it's something that we should constitute part of a personal financial plan. However, we find that a large number of consumers have still not embarked on this important aspect of their personal financial matters. In terms of a bare-bones approach and in response to your question, Appa, now, there are just four key aspects that I want to touch on for the Islamic world in today's segment. The first issue is that when a person prepares an Islamic world, then it should be borne in mind that there is no expiry date to an Islamic world. What this means is that once the world is in place and it's done, it can be regarded as something that is done and dusted, and it remains intact until there is no clear revocation of your earlier Islamic world. So until and unless there isn't a revocation of a world, that current one which a person has put together is something that will remain valid and will be effective on the demise of an individual. Now, we often get this question about how often should I update my world? A simple rule of thumb is to update the world at least every 3 years. Or if not in every 3 years, then upon the occurrence of a major life event, such as marriage, maybe a significant illness, or even the birth of a child. But those are important events which would determine the need to revoke your previous will and revise the will for one's management of personal financial affairs. So it is important to firstly ensure that one has a will and know that it does not have an expiry date to it. The reason why revocation is important, if a person does revoke any previous will, this is important. If you're updating the will, revocation of a previous one is important because it will help in the event of a dispute. So let's say a typical case of someone in the family or an heir disputing that they're entitled to something from the will, then one could rely on the updated will, whereas the plaintiff may be holding on to the previous will. You know, so when updating the will, it's also important to keep in mind the importance of revoking the previous one. And this is why standard form wills that are prepared by Islamic organizations are prepared in such a way that they are geared towards specific mentioning of revoking of a previous will. And this is why it's important to keep in mind that using a standard form will has some kind of benefits, but there's still a need to sit down and discuss the pros and cons of that specific will. So the first aspect I want to touch on is the issue of the expiry date on a will, which does not necessarily apply. The second and probably one of the most important aspects of an Islamic will is the aspect of naming an executor. Now, the executor is, in simple terms, the individual who will step into the shoes of the deceased and conduct financial affairs of the deceased person. So the executor itself can be someone who is an heir to the estate. It can be, let's say, a son or even a wife or even a husband, depending on whose will is being drafted. But it can be an heir to the estate who fulfills the role of an executor. And it is important in this regard to make sure that one is specific in identifying the executor. Who exactly is the executor? Is it the son? If it's one of the son, then which son? Or if it's a daughter, which daughter? Or if it's the wife or husband, the name must be mentioned. Similarly, if a person is appointing more than one executor, then how is that documented in the will? Because a person cannot just put two names without any kind of link stating are both of them executors, or is only one executor, or is only one executor in the absence of the other. So those are important elements to keep in mind. But I think let us suffice on saying that the naming of an executor is important. Without going to the specifics, if anyone has specific queries relating to naming of an executor, we can always deal with that at a later stage. But that's the second point. The third point is the importance of informing one's family members where the will is kept. Because one is having the will, but if people are not informed about where the will is kept, this could possibly defeat the whole purpose of doing the will, because if people cannot find it, it's almost as if it doesn't exist. And therefore, it makes it difficult for one is to manage the financial affairs after a person passes on. The fourth and final aspect for today's segment is the issue of witnesses to a will. It is important to keep in mind regarding witnesses that you need a minimum of two, first of all. Second of all, those witnesses need to be above the age of 14, and they cannot be beneficiaries to the estate. This is where the difference is with the executor. The executor can be an heir to the estate, but the witnesses cannot be beneficiaries to the estate itself. So these are just four issues in response to your request for a bare-bones approach to an Islamic will.
All right. Now, these wills can be, the Jumayyat, I know, offers the service, and certain banks do as well. Is it prudent for people to approach institutions like their banks to get their Islamic wills drawn up?
It is an avenue to pursue. It is just a matter of being aware of what having a financial institution as your executor entails. So, for example, the executor's fee would eventually be allocated for the bank for the benefit of the bank. So, let's say, if I recall correctly, the fee for an executor is about, I think, 3.5%. I'm not too sure. I'm subject to correction on that one. But that executor's fee would then go to the financial institution if the institution is appointed as an executor to the will.
Okay.
Whereas if the same is done with maybe, say, a family member, member may be willing to say, you know what, I'm a person of means, I'm willing to wind up the estate because of my relationship with the deceased, and I'll waive my right to any fees so that the heirs could benefit. That's basically what it comes to.
All right. Well, the next thing we're looking at is something quite important. It's mislabeling of food is not a commercial crime, but one against humanity. I totally agree with that, and I want to hear what you have to say on that subject.
Appa, you know, I found the statistics really staggering and shocking. According to the Marine Stewardship Council, 30% of seafood on the international market is incorrectly labeled. 30%, that is a huge amount, and it's really staggering to note that seafood is undergoing such mislabeling, knowing that seafood can have such disastrous consequences on the health of an individual if they have any kind of ailment, you know. Now this whole issue of labeling of mislabeling of seafood is purely a result of how global supply chains are inadequately regulated. One would assume that global supply chains are fairly in order in terms of regulation, but this is not the case, and more so when it comes to seafood. Now, the reason why seafood is often mislabeled is one. Is the issue of the vendor being motivated to boost profit. So
yes.
Something which is obviously of a inferior quality would be labeled as something which is of superior quality, and in the process the vendor gains some kind of profit out of their whole exercise, which is obviously, as you said correctly, it's a crime against humanity to be doing that kind of practice. And then the aspect of the second issue, second cause of it is sometimes accidental, because many a time you find people who are working on the ground regarding or handling seafood are ordinary laborers who don't realize the significance of separating different kinds of marine species. So you find that mixing does tend to happen, and this kind of mixing is eventually not filtered later on in the food supply chain. So the implications of this kind of mislabeling is eventually so dire that consumers who have specific kind of risks in terms of health eventually end up consuming these commodities. So you find like sometimes a person who has such an allergy or ailment would purchase something with under notion that it's the right thing and something which is agreeable to their condition, and then they would have a reaction, and this has happened in the recent past. So these kind of occurrences can have dire consequences for ordinary consumers. I think for us as consumers, the important thing is what can we do to make sure that we are protected from the mislabeling, the practice of mislabeling of seafood. For me, I think the best and the most easiest way to do it is to probably rely on the Marine Stewardship Council's blue fish tick label. You know, they've got it on fish products, the blue tick. It's actually a shape of a fish. That's basically one of the most reliable ways of making sure that you purchase the correct seafood, because there are some kind of regulatory processes involved when seafood products are sold under the Marine Stewardship Council guideline.
You know, talking about mislabeling of foods, and you've brought up the one on fish and seafood, that kind of thing. It's important also because as an advocate to this kind of for pollution on a global sphere, one of the things that they've noticed is that a lot of fish being sold, especially in our eateries these days, are from the endangered species, like, for instance, your kingklip. And people don't know the difference. So if somebody is selling you a fish that's actually not kingklip, or if they are selling kingklip and they're not supposed to, it also brings up issues of it's not mislabeling as such, but it's actually just, you know, people being unaware of the fact that this is an endangered species that shouldn't be sold. And having the blue tick, as you said, in the shape of a fish, is very easily noticeable, and you'll find it at a lot of the very well-known eateries that do serve fish. So please keep an eye out for that, because we also have the fact that a lot of the fish that we take for granted as being very tasty on the table are the endangered species that are, you know, leaving our oceans, and that's causing a break in the food cycle. So obviously we need to be very aware of that as well.
Yes, very valid points. I think in the report that has been released by the Marine Stewardship Council, these issues of endangered species actually being harvested for consumer value is causing a huge harm and a knock-on effect in terms of the marine life, in terms of ecosystems. So this is important to keep in mind. You raised two very important points there, and both of them are mentioned by the, or emphasized by the Marine Stewardship Council report?
Well, if you want to know more about that, I think you can access their website and you'll be able to find quite a bit of information with regards to that, inshallah.
Sure.
So the next thing, we're moving back onto land and we're looking at motor vehicle safety features that should come as a standard, but in South Africa they don't.
Yes, this is very concerning, and if I look at the Automobile Association's campaign on Safer Cars for Africa, they conduct tests on various motor vehicles in South Africa. And according to a recent test conducted by the Automobile Association of South Africa, only 1 in 12 cars tested has something called electronic stability control. Only 1 in 12 cars. What this means is that, just keep in mind that electronic stability control is a feature in a motor vehicle which has, it's basically life-saving technology, which is controlling the vehicle for the benefit of the occupants of that motor vehicle. Now, electronic stability control in South Africa, unfortunately, has to be bought as an optional extra, whereas in many parts of the world, electronic stability control is a standard feature when buying a car.
Uh-huh.
So I find it very staggering that from the 12 car tested, only one basically meets the requirement in the South African context, or the specific survey or study done by the Automobile Association. What was shocking is that the issue of the motor vehicle Datsun, you know, Datsun Go, it's become increasingly prevalent in the South African market, and many individuals opt for it because it's a cheaper option. But according to the survey, the vehicle doesn't have security features. In fact, the motor vehicle itself is banned in all but four countries in the world. So I found it really staggering that something like this is being promoted on the market. Many consumers are falling for it, whereas motor vehicle occupant safety is a priority and it should not. We understand that we have to be paying for specific value, but when it comes to safety, these things should not be promoted as optional extras that we have to pay for. They should ideally come standard on a motor vehicle.
That's really concerning, because when you know, the Datsun Go that you just mentioned is usually punted as a car for students because it's, economically viable for them, as they say. So it's scary to think that, as you say, banned in most countries except four.
Yes. This is really shocking. In fact, it's banned in all but four countries.
That's really scary because, we're seeing these things being advertised and people are actually going out to buy them because they're seen as economical cars. But, a little bit of, research like you've been doing now shows us that this isn't always the case. So I think for consumers it would be very, very important that you do a bit of research into buying cars and the likes, because this is what we are now faced with, and it's really, really a scary thing because, as a parent, I would just assume that, this is a good car and it's being, punted as a car for a student. So you're buying it for a young person who's already a little bit of a risk on the road, because young people tend to drive more faster than usual, and they want to really, they try to be as confident as possible, especially ones who've just gotten their licenses and that kind of, don't have much experience as such. And you're putting them into a car that you say now is banned in most countries except four countries. It is really scary.
I think what's concerning, Appa, is the issue of how when we purchase motor vehicles, right? Many a time we find we look for optional extras. In your example of youth, we look for optional extras that are attractive for youth. We look at the subsidiary or the least significant issues, but safety is very seldom an item that features on our list of requirements when purchasing a motor vehicle.
And that's something that we should really put on the top of the list because, you're putting yourself... I always tell my daughter that having a car is equal to having a weapon in your hand, because how you use it is absolutely up to you. You could use it to injure people. Sometimes unconsciously when we create accidents because you may be talking on a cell phone or that kind of thing, it's a weapon in your hand.
Yes.
So it's really a really scary thought, but something that we need to be very, very aware of. Okay, the next topic we're dealing with is something I'm sure a lot of people in certain areas of Durban, and if they're listening, I hope that they are, because this is really important, where businesses are suddenly being established next to where you live. So you have business that's become a neighbor to you, and sometimes the business isn't what you want next door to you. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Appa, you know the occurrence of a trade establishment right next to where you stay in a residential suburb, it has its own kind of risks that come with such a thing. So on one hand, it's convenient that you got a business right next door to you or down the road or nearby, but it presents its own kind of risks. Obviously, the criminal element is there. The aspect of just maybe more traffic than you expected or you bargained for when you purchased a property, or the general issue of hindrance of people frequenting the area which you are not accustomed to in the recent past. You know, so it can become a nuisance. But this is an aspect of law, and this is why I must be very careful here and mention to our listeners that if anyone is in this kind of predicament, it's important to keep in mind the options you have, and these need to be explored with a legal expert. However, just to sum it up, the first aspect to look at, there are basically two aspects. One is the issue of restrictive condition in terms of the title deed of the property that is now being converted from a residence into a business premises. So one is restrictive condition on that property, and the second issue is the aspect of zoning of the property. What is it zoned for? Is it zoned for residential use only? Is it zoned for residential use together with business use? So these are two important aspects that need to be looked at when it comes to wanting to exercise one's right as a neighbor. Now, it may come as a surprise to many people, but you can determine the title, the restrictive conditions on a property through the deed office. Right? You can do it on your own without contacting the other party. Or you can do it preferably with the assistance of an attorney. So determining the restrictive condition is doable. It is possible to access and find out whether there are any restrictive conditions on the property which disallow the neighbor from engaging in commercial activity on their premises. On the issue of zoning information can be acquired at your local municipality. I know it may be a bit of a frustrating experience depending on the efficiency of the local municipality, but it is an option. It is one road to take in terms of exercising or determining what your rights are as a neighbor in terms of the property that has now been converted into a commercial enterprise. Now, I must add a rider that I'm not necessarily referring to the business of someone who is, you know, a widow who's struggling and selling roti or samosas.
Yes.
So that's very different kind of thing. I'm referring to a full-on business, you know, where it's now a business premises where there's signage, there's parking bays for patrons, and all of that kind of thing. So it's a full-on business as opposed to being something which is meant to be a residential premises. So it can be a hindrance to many people, but just keep in mind there's two things. Number one is the restrictive conditions which may or may not apply on that property. And the second aspect is the issue of zoning. And both these pieces of information can be obtained by someone. Through the assistance of an attorney, and the other through the local municipality.
All right, the reason I actually brought up earlier on mentioning Durban was recently there's been in certain suburbs in Durban where businesses have come up, and like you said, full-on businesses in a suburb. So some of these businesses haven't been, they're more of the shadier option, and people have been complaining, and it's taken years, in fact, to get, in one case, it's taken almost, I think, 4 or 5 years to get the business shut down, which eventually happened, but a lot of, legality behind it, a lot of court time and that kind of thing, before the business was eventually shut down. And I think recently there was one where there was a backpackers business being run somewhere in Johannesburg that for years there as well had been causing quite a bit of issue with regards to the parking, the usage of the area around, the disturbances, the late night partying in that area, which caused a lot of problems for the neighbors in those areas. So if you do come across that, there's the information for you. You can check on these businesses to see if they are able to be operating in your area legally.
what I'm concerned about is there are some kind of legal costs that could be incurred. But for now, the main idea of bringing it onto the table is for ordinary consumers to just be aware that you do have rights, and there's the basic way forward in terms of determining your rights is firstly to determine whether there are any restrictive conditions, because if there are no restrictive conditions, then you as a neighbor could land up in a very embarrassing situation trying to fight something which you have no leg to stand on, you know. And the second issue is the zoning issue, which is within your control to determine at your local municipality.
And I think also, you know, being neighborly would be a good thing as well, because you can actually speak to the person that's got the business running to find out a little bit more before you take any action against them. So that would be important as well.
Most definitely. I think let's not discount the importance of that, because the importance of communication before embarking on the legal route, which leaves bitterness between two neighbors and will have disastrous consequences for as long as you live and occupy your own premises. It's something no one would want to live with. So before going the legal route, it will definitely help to adopt some kind of alternative effective communication techniques to just determine each other's rights and obligations, expectations and so forth, but talk about it before embarking on the legal route, because that legal route could leave a huge amount of bitterness between two neighbors.
Exactly. And, okay, so we're talking about a book that's been written by Robert Kiyosaki, and it's called Fake is the Name. And tell us what it's all about.
You know, Robert Kiyosaki wrote Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which hit the shelves not too long ago and became a very famous hit for many people who have interest in business and finance. Now, the long and short of Robert Kiyosaki's latest book called Fake is that he posits that the financial system is going to collapse. We are sitting on very dangerous ground, because even after the 2008 financial crisis, there hasn't been much innovation in terms of genuine assets which are being traded on financial markets. By and large, we have what we could call and sum it up as derivative instruments or paper assets which are being traded on financial markets. So it's not actual assets that are being traded, it's derived values from an asset which are being traded between people. Now, Robert Kiyosaki in his book believes that gold is God's money. He calls it God's money. His basis for it is that it's been traded for thousands of years and has a great amount of stability and so forth. But what he does mention is that gold should not be viewed as something which can generate profit for you. So an individual should not engage in trading or obtaining gold with the intention of deriving profit. It's purely a hedging mechanism or a safety mechanism if paper assets are rendered void of any value. So it is important to keep in mind that he's not talking about gold as a profit mechanism or as a mechanism for generating huge gains, but more as a hedge against collapse of your ordinary paper currency. That's the first important point he makes in his book. The second important point is that he views property as a viable alternative for generating healthy returns. And he has this very specific technique in how property should be obtained and how should you maximize gains from owning a property. It's not just the issue of buying a property and then letting it out and earning rental income. He has a very specific technique which makes the book interesting to read. I must say that the book itself does, when you read it on first impression, you get the impression that it's disjointed, it's a bit repetitive, but it's a good book in the sense that it's one of those that present an alternative, or how can I say, out-of-the-box thinking away from the conventional ways of thinking about money and about assets, and it dismisses this whole idea of what I talked about earlier on, where the world is functioning or running on paper assets like stocks, bonds, unit trusts, exchange-traded funds, and all of those kind of things. I'm not going into the detail for ordinary consumers, but for now, I think that the mere fact that there's another book that is anti-establishment calling for the need for alternative assets, which is what I want to focus on. And when you talk about alternative assets, I'm talking about assets which we need. You know, if we trade in assets, if the world functions or financial markets operate on assets which we need, that's when value is created. So at the moment, we don't see much discussion on alternative assets like farming or alternative assets like energy sources or even alternative assets like infrastructure, you know. These discussions on these kind of assets are evolving very slowly, maybe a bit too slowly, and this is why we find that the world is just reliant on established systems which are not creating much value for consumers and economies globally, and this is why the book becomes interesting for those who have an interest in thinking alternatively in terms of money and finance.
A lot of what I've also noticed recently is that a lot of people are looking at Islamic finance, and there are people who are actually saying, pointing it as being, you know, maybe something that the world needs to look at, seeing that it has a better way of running business and that kind of thing. Do you think that there would possibly be somebody that would look into that on a better scale, maybe somebody like Robert himself, or do you think he would remain a capitalist in his thinking?
Look, at the end of the day, by and large, profit is what drives incentive to innovate and bring new things to the table. So even in terms of Islamic finance, at the moment, by and large, we find that individuals like Robert Kiyosaki would be averse to it on the basis of it being promoted as a faith-based alternative. By and large, these individuals are not individuals who would take to any financial system if it is overtly faith-based. And this is why it is important for us to realize that Islamic options of doing business are not only for Muslims, it is for the world itself. So in promoting it, they need to be packaged and sold as solutions for the world, not solutions for Muslims only. Because if you think of it in a simple example of any kind of consuming of harmful substances, you know, those harmful substances, consuming them is not only harmful for a Muslim or prohibited for a Muslim, it's prohibited for the world. When Islam prohibits it, when the Quran prohibits it, it doesn't only prohibit it for Muslims, it's prohibited for the world. Similarly with riba and any other kind of commercial concept, if it's prohibited for Muslims, it means it is prohibited for the world. And this is why we need more discussion on how to promote Islamic finance such that it is not seen as an alternative only for Muslims of the world. It's a solution for the world itself. And then apart from that, the whole issue is how individuals are turning away from Islamic finance on the basis that it is converging too rapidly with the conventional system rather than charting a path of its own. It is being too path-dependent on the conventional system, and this is why many kinds of accusations are being leveled against practitioners of Islamic finance.
Just, you know, on the book itself, you've read it, I'm sure, so you're looking at some of the points. What else can we gain from reading the book? I mean, other than the fact that he's talking about these currencies. I mean, recently I've seen an article about him having gone bankrupt. So do you think that his book will be seen as legitimate?
Very good question here. I have a serious thought on whether his book will gain some kind of legitimacy, because the book, first of all, as I said earlier on, is disjointed. It's a bit repetitive. Many a time, it oversimplifies what is quite technical. So if you look at it from if you look at the book from just the values of investment, you find that it kind of promotes the idea that if you do what I did, you will succeed, which is a fallacy in the world of finance and investment.
Yes.
What works for one person does not necessarily work for the other, especially when it comes to finance. So this is why his book will be viewed very skeptically in the market.
All right, I was just putting that out there because I was reading about it, having read his first book. So I saw that and I was quite worried when I saw the topic that you had brought up, because I was wondering whether people would actually look at him now as being legitimate, because there's been quite a bit of talk with regards to his bankruptcy. But Jazakallah khair for sharing that with us.
I think so. But the issue is, in terms of his book, the main issues which I gravitate towards is that the anti-establishment is bringing the topics onto the table, and what is the second thing is the issue of the discussion on alternative assets like farming, alternative energy and infrastructure, which is by and large missing from the discourse, mainstream discourse on alternative assets.
And it's something that as South Africans I think we should look at, because those alternatives are pretty good for us. I mean, when you look at farming, South Africa has a good infrastructure, as well as the fact that many institutions are coming up. I mean, when you look at how farming has evolved in South Africa and the different aspects of farming, I mean, we don't have just a single aspect of farming. We've got quite a broad if you look at Moringa leaves, for instance, the farming of that has become quite prevalent and has become big business for some people in these little farms that they once thought were just, you know, home-based businesses.
Indeed, just this week, statistics were revealed regarding the issue of South Africa being the fourth largest exporter of lemons to the world. And that's something, the ability which we often undermine. So there is huge potential in that regard, and there are alternative operators now, financial houses, who are exploring the avenue of creating investment value in terms of farming when they're using Internet of Things to merge your investment and to be able to monitor your investment in farming. They are bringing together technology to make sure that you as an investor will have a trackable path for the performance of your investment if you were to go into farming.
All right, well, let's end it there for today. Jazakallah khair for your time and for all the information that you send to us or give to us, and we really, really do appreciate it. And inshallah, we'll try and make the show a little more interactive in future. I think, you know, if people could call in with some of their questions, if you agree to that, that would be great as well.
Most definitely, that will be welcome. Even the issue of any clarity, if it is required on any of the topics we're bringing up, our listeners are welcome to contact us and let us know where we can provide clarity or even further exploration or unpacking of the specific topics that we are discussing.
All right, inshallah. Jazakallah khair and assalamu alaikum from us.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Well, there you go. That's our conscious consumer for today. And inshallah, we'll be back next week with more information, more good topics that we normally talk about. And alhamdulillah, I must say, I do enjoy the consumer slot as well as the others as well. Quite a bit of information that can be garnered there. Like we said, if you'd like to call in, you're welcome to do so. And we'll be back with you next week. From me, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.